Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we're going to do some Secure Freedom Radio. Now, I want to open up the show with a little rant about a distasteful subject, but one that has been front and center for it seems like most of my adult life. Politics. It's a dirty game, and the people who play it are all too often willing to do almost anything to get what they want. Now, that is true in the best of times, and these most certainly are not the best of times. Now, the Hillary Clinton campaign has recently been rocked by the release of a large cache of emails from her campaign manager, a guy named John Podesta, who is a veteran political tool, and he founded a think tank that seems to basically parrot the Democratic left liberal progressive mindset for anyone who's willing to use it. And both Obama and Hillary have been massive users of it. But he is now her campaign manager, essentially the person who decides what that campaign is all about. And these tens of thousands of emails have been outrageously indicative of what a moral and ethically free zone that campaign actually is. Now, I want to jump to what I think is a disqualifying of your humanity event that John Podesta happened to comment on and happened to show just why I don't think he should be shunned from polite society, and he and anyone who works with him should never be anywhere near the levers of power. I want you to think back to the night of the attacks in San Bernardino. Throughout the day, information was coming out about this horrific shooting. We knew people had been slaughtered. We knew basically that the people attending a holiday party had been killed while celebrating. But we didn't know all that much about who had done it. You know, through the day, the police, as usual, had been somewhat circumspect about talking about who it was and anything they knew. But as the day progressed and as we got towards evening, information came out. And we actually have an ally who lives out in that area and heard on the police scanners the name of the suspect the police were looking for, who turned out, along with his wife, to be the killer. Saeed Farouk was his name. And I was on the O'Reilly Factor that evening, and at 8 o'clock, before any other major media outlet had announced it, I gave Bill O'Reilly his name, and we put it out there. And it is a Muslim name. Now, that led a lot of people to see their greatest fears realized. No one wanted another terrorist incident in the United States, yet now we were confronted by that horror, by a mass killing by a jihadist on our soil. It's something that, again, the idea that this could happen in a town like San Bernardino, this wasn't New York, this wasn't Washington, D.C., it wasn't even Los Angeles. San Bernardino is out in the desert. It's a tiny little place. It is essentially small town America. So the fact that a terrorist incident had happened there struck at the heart of everyone. And we all felt for the families. We all knew that innocent people had died. And again, our enemy had managed to strike in a horrific way here in the United States. Well, that really wasn't what was on John Podesta's mind that evening. Because this disgraceful human being, this waste of human flesh, this oxygen thief, managed to send an email that night just after the name came out. And he wasn't watching Fox News, shockingly. He was watching MSNBC and a little tool named Chris Hayes' show. And Chris Hayes announced the name, and John Podesta sent an email to another member of the Clinton camp saying, "God, wouldn't it have been better if instead of Chris Hayes announcing that a guy named Saeed Farouk had done this shooting, a guy named Saeed Farouk was announcing that Chris Hayes had done the shooting. He was essentially taking this entire incident, this entire chance to show your humanity, to care about the people who'd been killed, to care about the United States, the attack we're under, the enemy who managed to come to this country and kill innocent people again. And instead of any of that, his only thought was, wouldn't it be better for our political prospects if this was a white guy killing Muslims instead of a Muslim killing everyday Americans? I can't even fathom the lack of humanity it takes to look at an incident like that and have that reaction. I'm not sure I could look Mr. Podesta in the face and want to do anything other than choke the life out of him. What a horrible person it takes to do that. And the idea that this is the man who runs Hillary Clinton's campaign, this is the man who decides what they talk about, what they care about, what they do. So instead of having an ounce of common decency, he looked at the incident and he was hoping that it was a white guy killing Muslims rather than a Muslim killing the rest of us, so that he could use that for Hillary's advantage. I can't trust a person like that with our safety, with our security. That is, in my mind, a disqualifying event for the Clinton campaign. But of course it's not. Are you hearing about that in any of the rest of the media? Of course not, because it's far too embarrassing. A few brave souls have actually talked about it, but the bulk of the media has ignored it and is busy talking about the horrible things Donald Trump has done, none of which involve trying to use terrorist attacks for political gain. Now, there are so many issues of corruption and basic lack of decency revealed in these emails that it would be hard to pick just a few to focus on. But there was another one, and this came out when Podesta was releasing transcripts of Hillary Clinton's speeches. Now, these are the talks she's been avoiding anyone seeing, where she was talking to Goldman Sachs and other high-speed Wall Street investors to the tune of $300,000 and $400,000 for a one-hour speech, okay? Now, I don't think any of us sentient human beings, anyone with an above-room temperature IQ, thinks that they're doing that because Hillary Clinton is an entertaining speaker. They're buying access. She ran a pay-for-play operation when she was Secretary of State, using the Clinton Foundation to rake in the cash and the State Department to dispense the favors. So now, people who know she's got a sadly all too good a chance to be the next president, we're buying access by paying her way more than she's worth to talk for an hour or so. And Hillary obviously was telling them what they wanted to hear, but not what she wanted the rest of us to hear. And that's where these email revelations should be damaging, unfortunately not damaging enough to her. One of the things that she said that I think is as telling as basically is what Mr. Podesta said, because it's going to lead to the same result. She was talking about the Syrian refugee crisis. Okay, now nobody denies that there is a humanitarian crisis, that people are suffering, that this is a horrific situation. The question is what to do about it. Now, Hillary and the rest of her team think that the thing to do is bring them here. Why not? America's a great place. We've got plenty of resources, we can do whatever we want, and isn't it just the right thing to do? Well, while the sentiment of wanting to help these people is good, the fact is the FBI director has said categorically that we have absolutely no ability to vet these people and make sure that we're not bringing in terrorists like Saeed Farouk and the rest, along with the refugees we would purportedly be helping. Here's what Hillary said when she was talking about this to Goldman Sachs. She was talking about the people leaving Syria, and she said they can't possibly vet all those refugees. So they don't know if, you know, jihadists are coming in along with legitimate refugees. That's what she said in private. In her public speeches, when she is running for president of the United States, she says the exact opposite. She says, of course we can vet him. There's a rigorous vetting process going on. And it's just the right thing to do. We need to bring them here. I don't know what to say about someone who's willing to lie about something that important. The first thing I'd say is you obviously cannot trust her with our safety and security. But the bottom line is, that's a decision everyone is going to have to make for themselves on November 8th. This is Jim Hansen, and up next, we'll be talking with Mike Pregent, who is in Iraq and is going to update us on the battle to retake Mosul.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and we have right now Michael Pregent, who is a visiting fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, but more importantly, who is a gentleman sitting in Erbil right now. Visiting what is the front lines of the offensive to retake Mosul and push ISIS out of Iraq and hopefully Syria. Mike, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. Give us your one over the world view of what's going on there and how things are going.
Oh, thanks for having me. Well, so far, you know, it's being touted as an Iraqi military operation with allied forces. The Peshmerga are having success. The Iraqi army is having success in clearing out some of these villages. Again, a lot of them have already been depopulated. The wild card remains, what are the Shia militias going to do? We've heard just in the last couple of days from Qais Khazali, leader of Asaba Ahl al-Haq, saying that he's not asking the Iraqi government for permission. He's telling the Iraqi government the militias will be part of the Mosul offensive. That it's a revenge operation for Imam Ali, and his guys are carrying these Yah Hussein flags. So that's the wild card here. The other dynamic is the civilian population in Mosul, 1.5 million. What happens to them? Now, some of the positive reports are so far, the Iraqi military is receiving intelligence reports from these very civilians, these Sunni civilians in these villages, and they're giving them the actual locations of ISIS fighters and ISIS safe houses. That should be continued. My concern is that there's a rush to clear Mosul in the Ramadi fashion, where they simply destroy buildings that are on the path, on the route into the city center. And the benchmark is so low. This victory against ISIS so far has been, okay, let's depopulate a town, let's knock down some buildings, and let's replace the ISIS flag with an Iraqi flag and call it done. And you and I both know that's not how you do counterinsurgency.
And unfortunately, I think you kind of pointed out what the real danger is. If the Sunni civilians are cooperating now and helping identify ISIS locations, and those Shia militias come rolling in, their reward may be getting slaughtered for their help. You know, in the end, if this is allowed to happen, and like you said, I think the Shia militias, who are backed by Iran and in a lot of cases are led by Iranian IRGC and other troops. If they're running rampant, this is really going to be a World War II like flattening of a city and killing everybody in the way.
It's a big concern, and the government will say the Iraqi the Shia militias, the Iranian sponsored or backed Shia militias, are not part of the offensive. They're part of the offensive if they're in artillery range or if they're in sniper range. And their plan is to be within artillery range. They're supposed to basically guard the perimeter of Mosul, meaning that as refugees pour out of Mosul, they're going to run into Shia militia checkpoints. And what we've seen in Ramadi and Fallujah is these militias will separate the military-age males. They'll put them on a truck and they'll send them off somewhere. And then they'll take pictures with the women and children and tout it as some sort of victory, some nationalist victory. See, look, we're here to liberate the women and children. But all those military-age men, to them, are ISIS collaborators, and they go away to be questioned, tortured, in some cases executed.
Now, obviously, if they're doing that, and if they look at it, if the Shia militias look at it as a revenge mission, and the Iraqi troops go in, let's do clear it. Let's do. And I kind of question the timing of this operation happening right before the U.S. election. But so what? In the end, it is the right thing to do. We do need to retake Mosul. But who's going to keep Mosul? How are they going to govern that if they have created this situation where the Sunni civilians have been poorly treated, are going to be treated worse, I think, unfortunately, in the days ahead? And then who's going to govern them?
Well, that's one of the problems with Mosul, and you could argue with West Iraq, is there's a leadership vacuum. You can't identify a Sunni leader in Iraq that hasn't already been targeted, killed, either by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or Shia militias, or exiled by the Iraqi government. So they have a leadership vacuum. Then they also lack leverage with Baghdad. They lack leverage with the United States. So it's a big question. And I would argue, during the U.S. Occupation of Iraq, we never secured Mosul. We simply pacified Mosul. We simply did enough to discourage all-out chaos. And, you know, the Iraqi army wasn't able to secure Mosul either, with ISIS coming in 2014. Again, it was a very different Iraqi army division than the one that I was embedded with in 2005 and 2006. In that it was filled with Maliki loyalists as opposed to Sunnis and Kurds that are actually from Nineveh province that knew every neighborhood, every street, every block, and every tribal leader. So one of the biggest problems now is what happens the day after. You have the Turkish forces in the north of Mosul. You have the Shia militias. You have the Peshmerga. You have the Iraqi army. Then you have the heavily bought or infiltrated federal police, each with different missions going into Mosul. And I would argue with ISIS being third down on their priority lists, number one and two being make sure the other groups don't get as much territory as we get.
Right. And Mosul is really a place where all three of the major groups all have a dog in that fight. They all are concerned about the oil and the fact that that's a major crossroads and all the rest of it. They all want a piece of that. What is the feeling among the Kurds as far as their, I guess, forward-leaning ability to carve out their chunk?
I think the Kurds are participating in the operation more for leverage with Baghdad and leverage with the United States. They've given assurances that they're not going into Mosul. And I believe them because they really don't have any interest in going into Mosul. They're more concerned about holding on to Kirkuk. And I've been told repeatedly by Peshmerga generals, listen, we can defeat ISIS. ISIS isn't the problem. It's this 100,000 strong Shia militia organization called the Hashd al-Shaabi, led by Iranian proxy operatives like Hadi al-Amri and al-Muhandis, the leader of Kitab Hezbollah, with people like Qais Ghazali saying these things. They're worried about them because they've got their eyes on not only Mosul, but they've got their eyes on Kirkuk as well.
And Kirkuk is where the oil is. I mean, Kirkuk is the main thing that has to be hashed out. Is there a feeling among the Kurds that that is, like you said, that's where they will plant their flag, in essence, and use this as their ability to have a bargaining chip, like you said, have some leverage with the Iraqi government in the hopes then that that allows them the opportunity to hold the line at Kirkuk?
I mean, Iraq is like the game of Risk. If you have more troops on that on the territory than your enemy or your competitor has, then you control it. And the Kurds believe they control Kirkuk, even though Baghdad says legally you do not. The Kurds have the forces there. The Kurds took it, secured it, and made it safe after ISIS came in. So, yeah, there's that. But, again, there's encroachment. The Shia militias are in Hawija. The Shia militias are just south of Kirkuk. And they're in mass there. There are more Shia militia groups in that area than there are partaking in the Mosul offensive.
Well, and again, that shows their priority. They're willing to play and be a team player. And unfortunately, they've been, you know, one of our best allies, and we just seem never able to reward them in the way they deserve. Is this potentially, as this plays out and ISIS gets pushed, and it looks like they're on the losing side of this, Is this a chance for the Kurds to consolidate? Is there any chance they're going to get anything other than a thank you, you know, and get some aid, get some military support, get the things they need to operate well out of this?
Well, it all ties back to the U.S. election and what happens and what assurances each candidate has given to the Kurds. And I haven't heard much from either candidate on what they plan to do.
Mike Pregent, in Erbil, watching events unfold on the ground. Thanks for joining us. Be safe. Up next, we'll be talking with Peter Husey, president of Geostrategic Analysis.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're joined now by Peter Husey, president of Geostrategic Analysis, and a gentleman who keeps a pretty good eye on how we're doing in the arms race and in our ability to maintain both a deterrent factor and, if needed, an offensive capability in the most important weapon systems. And Peter, I don't know, I don't get the feeling that that has been a priority for quite a while. Most of our major systems, nuclear, submarines, even down to the ground combat systems, seem to have been a far behind some of the other priorities as far as spending. Are we doing what we need to do to keep us safe and keep the world safe?
Let me give you a metaphor. If we're in a 100-yard dash, or let's say we're in a 4-mile race, it doesn't matter. We are tying our shoes, and our adversaries are in the final turn. Russia will finish its entire modernization program in 2022. The Chinese, not sure when, because they publish even less than the Russians. The thing is, our submarines have already been delayed at least 4 years compared to where the original proposals were. We're a decade and a half behind rebuilding our Minuteman ICBMs. And since we killed the B-2 bomber in the 1990s, we are 2 decades away from building a new bomber. In fact, we won't have a new bomber until the mid-2020s. So we are currently, if the current plan is played out, we have to cross our fingers and hope that the correlation of forces, as the Russians and Chinese look at it, won't matter than the fact that we're going to be playing catch-up for a while, because our first submarine, bomber, and ICBM doesn't come into the field until the late 2020s. And when we finish the program, it'll be good. But there are a lot of termites out there, as I call them, eating away at the nuclear foundation, and they would like to see the cruise missile on the bomber go away. They would like to kill four submarines out of the 12. They would like to kill Minuteman, the new Minuteman ICBM. So there's a consensus to go forward in Congress, and there is a fairly strong, well-funded group of folks who would like to kill a lot of things.
I think a part of the problem, President Obama comes from a school of thought that ending nuclear weapons globally is a possibility, and doing anything to further the, if not proliferation, even maintenance of current forces is a bad idea. So in his mind, if we're not, you know, putting them into mothballs, or better yet, completely destroying them, we're not doing our jobs, and consequently, there has been no focus. And even it sounds like, even if we continue with the current plan, that's barely going to keep us at pace with the Russians and Chinese, let alone put us in a position of dominance where they would have no idea they could try anything crazy.
Yeah, the thing is that I think, to be fair to the administration, the plan they have put forward that Congress has approved is a good one. There is a question in my mind, and then I think a lot of people's mind, is it could be faster. We could accelerate it. Remember that we take 12 to 13 to 14 years to time you do research and development until you actually procure something and put it in the field, and that's the initial capability. It's not the whole field. So we did go on what was known as a procurement holiday. In fact, I went back and read a report that Michelle Flournoy and Clark Murdoch wrote in 2002. They were both at CSIS, and they both said that we had used the nuclear forces to pay bills in the 1990s. And now we were stuck with three legs of the triad, that submarines, bombers, and ICBMs are old, cost a lot of money to maintain. And John Hamry, who is president of CSIS, who was very high up in the Pentagon in the 1990s, he really got religion when it came to nukes and said, we're in trouble. And he writes the introduction to this report that was, as I said, written almost 15 years ago. And it laid out the case for modernizing the nuclear deterrent, but they said, we got to get going. And as I said, you could write the same thing today. We are on the right path. The problem is, will there be pressures to divert from it?
I would hope if we were going to go on a procurement holiday, it would have been of the buying spree and get them while they're cheap variety. So we had these things in our arsenal as opposed to, you know.
No, I hear you. I hear you. But we have got, a lot of people may be interested in cost. If you take the bombers, the subs, and ICBMs, and don't take the warheads, don't take the command and control, and don't take sustainment, just the new parts, over the next 10 years, we will spend $67 billion sustaining the old stuff and $67 billion building new stuff. That's how expensive having old stuff is. It does get very costly. And because we delayed and kicked the can down the road which we did starting at the end of the Cold War, and we did it in the end of the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Bush 43, in 2010, Senator Kyle used the New START treaty that reduced weapons from 2,200 to 1,550. He said, wait a minute, before we reduce any further, let's agree on modernization. It was his insistence that the administration put in the budget coming in February of 2011, that the budget include a full-up modernization program that was submitted to Congress the previous December in classified form, which included 12 boats, at least 400 Minuteman, and upwards of 100 new bombers. All the bombers are going to be conventional anyway. Just some of them will be converted to a nuclear role, so you'd build the bombers anyway. But if you just add up the amount of money we're now spending per year on the platforms, the guts, it's $10 billion. Then you add in about $8 billion for the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is the warheads and the labs. You add in about $4 billion for command and control, which needs to be redone. And that's where you get the magic $24 billion a year, which we're now spending. It's going to go up to about $34. You can do the math.
I don't want to do the math.
Increase.
That's painful. All right, now let's take.
I want a 60% increase, and yet defense, the nuke part, will go up $10 billion, true, from 24 to 34, but then it peaks, then stays there for a few years, then comes down.
That one thing I've heard that worried me considerably is that President Obama might go to the UN during his lame duck time and get the Security Council to pass a nuclear test ban. Is that something that sounds to me like a horrifically bad idea? Not that we want anyone else testing, but don't we have to have at least that possibility?
I hear you. No, they did this. They went to the UN, and it was so watered down that it basically has no impact. Now, to be clear, people may claim it has because it's a resolution, but again, it's a symbol of, we haven't tested since, I think, 91 or 2. And there are those who I admire enormously who think that by computer simulation you can figure out a number of these things. But I think Frank, your boss, Frank Gaffney, I think Frank is right that you want to preserve the opportunity to test because that demonstrates the credibility of your systems. Now, the argument is if North Korea can't test, they won't develop. Well, if you look at the real experts here, Pakistan, India, North Korea, all these countries developed nuclear weapons without testing and then surprised us and said, here we are. Okay. They basically tested surreptitiously. They didn't test until later when India popped one off and then Pakistan said, oh, we got to. And then North Korea, of course, does it to demonstrate their coercive power with nuclear weapons. So I am not of the belief that stopping testing, which we have done unilaterally since 91, North Korea has, some people think, 100 nuclear weapons. Iran, we bribed them basically to pause, and Pakistan and India are going gangbangers. China is going gangbangers. The only limits are the United States and Russia, but Russia isn't limited in its theater missiles of nuclear weapons. And then the only countries really that have cut back are France, the United States, and Britain. And Russia actually was able to increase under the last treaty because they were in such bad shape during the 1990s and early 2000s when they were broke.
Peter Husey, President of Geostrategic Analysis, thank you for that cogent analysis of the difficulties we face in our nuclear and strategic weapons modernization. Up next, we'll be talking with Tom Trento of the United West. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We are joined right now by Tom Trento, who is founder of the United West and a gentleman who is making a pretty important documentary that I think all of you need to hear about and support and basically get involved with. It is the story of Extortion 17, which was the mission name for a SEAL Team 6 mission that was shot down under some pretty bizarre and troubling circumstances. Welcome to the show, Tom. Will you give us the one over the world view about that incident?
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. And you guys are doing great work there. Extortion 17, call sign for a helicopter, Chinook helicopter, carrying 38 human beings, 38 souls, 30 Americans, 17 of whom were SEALs, 15 of whom were SEAL Team 6. In fact, some of the same team that 91 days earlier took out Osama bin Laden. Maybe not the same guys, we don't know, but the same squad within SEAL Team 6. And there were 8 Afghans on board. Shot down by supposedly, and this is what the documentary is going to uncover, an RPG fired by the Taliban, and the helicopter crashed. But the real story is the cover-up of the shoot-down of SEAL Team 6. The documentary will show how the Obama administration and the U.S. government have covered up the actual situation behind the shoot-down, in particular the absolutely absurd and deadly rules of engagement.
Okay, now let's talk first about this particular mission. Now, they're flying a Chinook, which is a fairly normal transport helicopter, but usually special operators will travel on a special version of that, the MH-47 as opposed to the CH-47. Now, in this case, it sounds like they weren't on the special operations version of that bird.
No, they weren't. And that's one of the disastrous decisions resulting, and this is very important for your listeners. This occurred in August of 2011, August 6th. And if you remember, the political promise by the president was, I will have everybody out of Afghanistan by the end of 2011. So all the SF guys were ramping up to do not 2 or 3 missions a day, but 8, 9, 10 missions a day, crazy stuff. And as a result, they had to use second-hand aircrafts. And one of them was this transport helicopter, essentially a school bus, not a wartime fighting machine.
The difference being that the MH-47, the special operations version of that bird, is going to have much better electronics. It's going to be armed for self-protection, and, you know, not to say anything about the pilots flying that, but the folks in the special operations squadrons, which fly the MH-47 version, are the top pilots. That's how you get into those units, and you spend your time training, and your mission profiles are designed for the type of things that a special operations mission requires: low-level flight, insertion into hot LZs and all those kind of things. And unfortunately, the folks who fly the cargo version of that, the regular version of the CH-47 Chinook, don't have that level of training or experience.
Jim, over the past 5 years, you're exactly right. Our research has uncovered special operators that were there who will speak up in our documentary, who said whenever the call came to fly Extortion 17, the Rangers, Army Rangers, would go, hell no, man, we ain't going on that thing. That thing's doomed. And they would fly with 16 or with other teams that were flying the 160th Division of Special Operations. So they knew something was going to happen. And in particular, you talked about the pilot capability. There's a vast difference between a National Army National Guard pilot who was flying the school bus and the special operator pilots, and one in particular, one dynamic in particular, the landing. The Rangers told us that when the Chinooks came in for a landing, they would elevate down like you would step down. Real noisy. They'd go forward, drop 50 feet, go forward, drop 50 feet. I mean, anybody can shoot these things down like that. And the 160th aircraft, the special helicopters for special operations, would zigzag and make it virtually impossible by an RPG. They would hit the ground, and in seconds, everybody would be off.
Tom, one of the other problems you've highlighted was the rules of engagement and the ability of that bird to have the protection it needed. Tell us a little bit about how that could have affected the actual danger they were in.
Jim, we have absolutely groundbreaking factual material to present in the documentary. And it's called Fallen Angel because when a aircraft goes down in the military, it's called a Fallen Angel. And we have the transcript from the pilots flying in the gunships who said, what's going on? It's very dramatic audio. And they said, coalition, we have a fallen angel. And your heart breaks when you hear this. But we also have the fire control officer, a Air Force captain, a woman who was on station that night and watching everything from the AC-130. Now, this is the actual person who was there, who watched the whole thing happen, was arguing with coalition headquarters to lay down suppressive fire to clear the landing zone for Extortion 17. And when she was denied that, she saw through all their night vision that the threat had actually stopped the people they were following. So she said, look, the Rangers aren't in trouble. The groups of bad guys aren't there. Do not land. Do not let them land. And they overruled her because, as we found out, everybody wanted to, many of the officers wanted to say they served with SEAL Team 6. And if they launched a SEAL Team 6 mission, that would go on their resume as having operated in Afghanistan with SEAL Team 6.
So, I mean, that's outrageous, Tom. When you've got the eyes on the ground, the person with absolute situational awareness, and an AC-130 gunship, folks, is a giant cargo plane that has an amazing array of weaponry, but what it's also got is an amazing array of sensors. It's got cameras and night vision and infrared and every other type of the high-speed sensor equipment in the world. So the person on that bird has, without a doubt, the best view of the battlefield that you could possibly have. They're above it, and they're looking at it as clear as day. And they're saying, don't do this, and they were overruled.
Absolutely. And we have now the woman who was a fire control officer to this day suffers from PTSD as a result of watching 30 of her brothers go down. She had a very difficult time. And some of this is public now, so I can speak about it. Staying in the service, she wanted to be a career officer. She was in for 14 years. She decided to get out. She went through some therapy, all of that, and now she is speaking out on this. And this is going to be devastating, absolutely devastating to this administration. And the goal is to change the rules because the bad guys aren't going to stop fighting. We got to unleash our warriors. Jim, you were one of these guys. You know, you need to be unleashed to fight and kill the bad guys.
Well, folks, I would commend to you FallenAngelTheMovie.com. Go and check out what they're doing. Support it if you can. Tom, thank you for doing the tremendous work necessary to dig this up and to let the public know that we are not treating our folks the way we need to. Folks, that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.